The San Francisco Experience Podcast, brought to you by Jim Herlihy. Independent news commentary from a Silicon Valley perspective for a global audience, featuring newsmakers, thought leaders, and authors. Season 26, Episode 7, The Science Behind Artificial Intelligence and How It Will Improve Our Lives. Talking with Charles Martin. Hello, Chuck.
Hey, Jim. Thanks for having me.
Our guest today is Charles Martin, artificial intelligence specialist, distinguished engineer, inventor, and founder of Calculation Consulting. He specializes in machine learning, deep learning, data science, and AI software development. He has a PhD in theoretical chemistry from the University of Chicago, and he is a National Science Foundation Fellow. He joins us from his office in San Francisco. Again, Chuck, welcome to the show.
Great. Thanks for having me, Jim.
Chuck, please take a moment to tell us about your work as an AI inventor and some of the clients you work with through your company, Calculation Consulting.
Sure thing. So I've been doing machine learning and AI in Silicon Valley since the late 90s. I've worked with a number of clients. I was a subject matter expert at eBay, helping them build machine learning systems almost 15 years ago. I helped Aardvark design their very unique search engine that was acquired by Google. I developed the eHow Answer Factory algorithm. We were the first billion-dollar IPO since Google. And since then, I've done consulting for a number of clients like BlackRock, large clients like BlackRock and Walmart, building machine learning and AI solutions for them. And I've also worked with small clients, you know, such as small hedge funds and startups.
Mm-hmm.
All mostly here within Silicon Valley, but I've had some international clients as well.
Mm-hmm. Very impressive. 2023 marked a watershed year for artificial intelligence, at least in the public consciousness. I'm thinking of ChatGPT, OpenAI, Sam Altman, and of course, San Francisco, our own Cognitive Valley, seems to be at the center of it all. Tell us about the science behind artificial intelligence, and especially what you see as the emergence of signatures of artificial general intelligence.
Well, I have to tell you, it's a very exciting time. I've been working in AI since the 90s, and this technology was really developed in the academic labs. It dates back well over 50 years with some of the original work being done in theoretical physics and chemistry. I don't think a lot of people realize that. Why do you have theoretical chemistry? You're studying how neurons communicate with each other. And so this led to a number of very simple models way back in the 80s and 90s that we studied back during the Cold War, you know, and sort of when the Cold War ended, everybody left academics, funding dried up, people went off to Wall Street or Silicon Valley, and the AI research sort of died for a while. Yeah, but there were a few holdouts who kept it going. And what's happened is, you know, in the past 10 years or so, people have realized this stuff really works. And if you put a huge amount of capital behind it, you can get tremendous results. So I think that there's just been tremendous advances in compute power and data have allowed the technology to really expand. And what we're seeing now, I think, is really something quite remarkable. I mean, anyone who's worked with ChatGPT or just talks to it realizes this thing seems to understand something. You know, you interact with it, and it's able to answer questions. I mean, it does make mistakes. It makes things up. But yeah, but don't we all? You know, none of us have perfect memories. I have a 10-year-old niece. You know, she's very creative. She likes to make stuff up. It's the same thing. But when you interact with it, you realize there's something special here. There's something about building these giant mathematical models and just making them bigger and bigger and putting in more and more data that they are somehow able to learn something about the world simply by looking at text. They have some model of the world inside of them. It's very simple, very primitive, but there's definitely something there.
How do you respond to the critics who say that the sum of the parts can't be more than the whole? In other words, even with massive amounts of data that you're putting into these large language models, at the end of the day, it's masses and masses of data. And is there some magic that sort of elevates that massive amount of data to a level of cognition? or what? What do we have here?
So look, this is exactly the nature of my research in understanding what these signatures of intelligence are.
Yes.
Because I come from the background of a theoretical chemist and physicist. And in science, of course, you know, there are atoms and molecules, and you know, and then you go deeper and you have subatomic particles, and you go, the thing is that there are levels of scale. You know, you don't use subatomic particle physics to describe basic chemistry, and certainly not to describe biology. There are levels of scale, and we know from theoretical physics and chemistry that when you put large assemblies of, you know, molecules together, or atoms together, that new properties emerge. And in fact, not only do we know that these properties emerge, we know how to detect the signatures of emergence. Mm-hmm. So there are specific things. And an example would be, you know, when if you take a bunch of atoms and you put them in a pot, you have a pot of water. Well, so the emergent properties of steam are different. So this is very common in science, that there are different levels of scale. It's exactly what we're seeing in these neural networks. Mm-hmm. You take a very simple model, something that, you know, really was designed, things that come from the 80s and the 90s. There have been some significant advances. There's something called a transformer that was invented at Google, although one of my old classmates from when I was a postdoc kind of says, well, it's actually he invented it, but maybe he did. You know, the point is that you sort of build this, you scale it up, and you put more and more data into it, more and more compute, and some interesting property emerges. There's something about language. There's some property in the correlations between the words. And if you go and peek inside these models, you can actually see these kinds of properties. You can see you can actually see mathematical signatures. And the amazing thing is, and this is based on my own research, that these signatures of emergence you see resemble the same signatures you see if you were to just take some real neurons, like from a cat or from a mouse, mm-hmm. and culture them on a petri dish and watch how they behave, you would see the same kind of signals.
Hmm.
Now, of course, a petri dish with neurons on it, you know, culture is not a brain.
Right.
You know, it's not a fully functioning intelligent system, but there's some intelligence in it. You know, and these signatures that you see, they're called patterns, they're called avalanche patterns. These patterns of avalanches that you see in these cultured neurons are exactly the same patterns that you see inside the layers of these neural networks as they get better and better. And so there's absolutely something going on here that we don't fully understand.
Mm-hmm. So you've mentioned these signatures. What, say, for instance, me as a layman, I use ChatGTP a little bit. What are these signatures? Something that I, as a layman, might see, or would I need to have the level of research that you were just referring to in order to discern a signature of AGI?
Right. What I'm speaking of is I have actually built a tool called Weight Watcher that lets you go in and look for the signatures. So if you're a researcher, you can go and try to find them. But no, this is something very technical, right? This is something, in fact, if you're a neuroscientist or you're a theoretical physicist, or, you know, you're doing research in AI, as you're an engineer, as you're building these models and training them on these giant, you know, thousands of GPUs, you can go in and look for these signatures. And as the signature gets stronger, this is, you know, it's a mathematical signature. Something you would see like an X-ray machine of the model. Mm-hmm. And you go and you peek inside with the X-ray and you see this thing. And you'll notice that as the signature gets stronger, the model gets better in performance.
Tell us about Weight Watcher. Excuse me for interrupting, but I don't want to lose that thought. Tell us about weightwatcher.ai. First of all, the name. I mean, everybody's familiar with Weight Watchers. Of course, what you've done here has nothing to do with Weight Watchers, but tell us about that model, because that model, in fact, is developed to look for these emergent signatures, right?
Yeah. So about 10 years ago, when I started seeing this stuff get really popular. You know, I was at Aardvark, and Aardvark was acquired by Google, and then Google acquired DeepMind, and we realized there's something going on here. Like there's something really going on in AI right now. So I said, I'm going to get back into research. So, you know, I kind of cracked the books and, you know, went to the local coffee shops after work and started studying. And I was doing some research in joint with an old friend at UC Berkeley. And we began studying basically how these, what's happening in these models. And mm-hmm. at the time we began, you know, there were maybe a few models that academics were sharing. I think there were maybe 50 at the time. They call them open source models. There were 50 of them. And I began looking at them and just kind of peeking inside them. And the thing was that I didn't have access to the training data for these models. How do I figure out what's going on? I said, well, let me just see if I can look inside the models mm-hmm. and apply some of this knowledge I have from when I used to be a PhD in physics, you know, theoretical physics and chemistry. And so over time, we began to realize there's something very special going on here. You know, there's some very interesting property that's going on inside these models that no one had ever really thought to look for. And I had been aware of some of this because when I was a quant at BlackRock, I worked in the SAE group. This is the group that predicts the market.
Yeah.
And we have these techniques that we use to try to determine signal from noise. You know, how do you de-risk the market? How do you find signal from noise? And what's called portfolio theory. And I knew about these techniques. I said, what if I were to apply the same methods that you use to try to find signal in the stock market? What if I applied it to these layers inside these neural networks? And sure enough, we began seeing these very interesting signatures. And the amazing thing is more and more models started coming out, and they started getting better, and they started, you know, performing more, and people started sharing, and not just ChatGPT, but also image recognition, the models that are inside self-driving cars, for example. As we began looking at them, we realized, well, the signatures are getting stronger. And I, you know, and I had recognized this stuff, you know, back from my postdoctoral days. There's a theory called the critical brain hypothesis. Mm-hmm. And what it says is that our brains operate on a balance between order and chaos. And there's this sweet spot, this special spot where we have, where, you know, we're sort of right there between being, you know, some people say, you know, genius is almost like you're crazy or you're a genius. There's like this special sweet spot right there in between. Uh-huh. And it turns out that you can detect this. There's a signature you can detect, and it turns out they're in these models. And so the research led to an open source tool. I created an open source tool.
Which is Weight Watcher.
Uh-huh. Yes, that's Weight Watcher. Yeah, you know, it's a cute name because the layers inside a neural network, we say they have weight matrices. So Weight Watcher seemed like a cute name, you know, right? You know, so it took off. You know, we've had, you know, it was published in some major journals like Nature Communications and the AI journals and the big conferences. And we have, you know, 125,000 downloads. It's a tool that people use. And the idea being, you know, you want to be able to share the research and you want to make sure it's 100% reproducible. Mm-hmm. It's very important in science, right? You know, you're doing something, you want to show, because, you know, it's not perfect, right? But we've been able to really understand now that there's something very special going on inside these models that no one expected. And it's kind of shaken up the statistics, what's called the statistical learning theory community as well, because it's sort of the, you know, no one understands why these models work. Mm-hmm. They don't have a clue. They just don't. I mean, we're beginning to get some hints, but fundamentally, it's mostly brute force. And so, Weight Watcher is a way to try to help, you know, to shed some light on what's going on. And for me, it's sort of, I think we're sort of in the stage where the world was when the steam engine was discovered. Mm-hmm. And people started building steam engines. There was no thermodynamics. There were no theories of physics that said how steam engines work. People were just building them, and every once in a while, they would blow up. And you'd build another one. And mm-hmm. yeah. And eventually when we discovered thermodynamics, you know, now of course we have rockets and we have cars and we have spaceships. All of this came from understanding the physics, but the engineering came first. Mm-hmm. First came the development, and then later we began to understand the science. And I think that's sort of where we are now with AI. You know, that we're the engineers are just building these huge things. We're not really sure why they work. And Weight Watchers just one attempt to sort of peek inside the engine and try to figure out how the gears are moving.
So is Weight Watchers unique as a open source system that anyone can use to try to detect signature AGI? Is Weight Watchers unique, or are there other similar programs out there?
No, this is the only one. There are a lot of people trying to evaluate LLMs. Like, you know, they build, right. Like a company might build an LLM, and you want to know how it works. How do you evaluate it? Well, Weight Watcher is the only tool that lets you evaluate it without having any kind of bias on the data. Mm-hmm. You know, there is research now coming out, but there are some new techniques. For example, you can detect how well does the model compress data. So that turns out to also be fairly good. But you don't see the signature of emergence. You just sort of get an idea of how well the model will perform. Mm-hmm. But Weight Watcher is very unique in this sense. And, you know, I'll tell you kind of how I came up with the idea commercially is that I had a client of all places in Slovenia that wanted me to make fake text for them. Because, you know, they like weight loss articles, you know, and trying to, you know, fake reviews on Amazon, stuff like this, right?
Right.
People will pay for it. And, you know, we were doing this is years ago, and I was doing this. And I realized I don't have a way to judge whether the text I'm generating is any good or not.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if I'm lying, I'm making mistakes. I can't do it by brute force. You can't generate 50,000 weight loss articles and check that they're all the same. So I realized I need some sort of theory to explain, to help me judge how well the model is doing. Because I'm going to give a model to a client and charge him for it.
Right.
You know, there's an old joke in, you ever remember the movie Ghostbusters?
Yes, of course.
Remember, there's an old joke where they're in academics and they're going out in the industry. And I think it's Harold Ramis. It's either Harold Ramis or Dan Aykroyd. And he says to Bill Murray, he goes, you know, you've lived your whole life in academics. You've never been in industry. They expect results. That was the whole point of this tool is that, you know, if you're going to build something for someone and give it to them, you have to have some way of qualifying that it works.
Right.
You know, some sort of safety guarantee or some sort of security guarantee that the thing is actually working correctly. And this, I think, is the biggest problem we have right now with ChatGPT and these models is we don't know how they work and we don't know when they work. You know, you build a model for someone and you give it to them, they have to evaluate it. Well, you can't evaluate on every possible thing someone would ask. You know, it's impossible. So you have to have some way of doing this. Is probably the biggest problem right now in the whole field. You have companies trying to build these things and deploy them, and they have no idea what they're going to do.
Let me ask you a question. You said weightwatchers.ai is open source. Now, open source doesn't mean it's free, or does it mean it's free?
So there's an open source version and there's a commercial version.
Okay.
So the open source version is free. It's an Apache. It's all, you know, it's done in joint with UC Berkeley.
Yes.
And the open source version, it's called an Apache license. So it's totally free, totally open source. And we have a Discord channel and you can jump in and ask me questions. The commercial version is designed to run at scale. So if you're trying to evaluate something quickly or you want to integrate it into your company, then there's a commercial version. So it's very much like other open source products where the open source product is free. And the commercial version is designed to be easy to use, runs faster, handles all the software stuff that and compute stuff that you don't want to have to deal with.
So is weightwatchers.ai then, without giving up confidentiality rules, et cetera, so is weightwatchers.ai, is that used by OpenAI, by Meta?
You know, weightwatcher.ai, it's a funny thing. You don't get a lot of feedback on who uses it.
Uh-huh.
So we did have Meta approach me to use it.
Yes.
But I have no idea whether they're using it or not. You know, so I talked to them about, you know, they have this problem that they have, you know, $80 billion flowing through their system and, you know, the models crash all the time. They have no idea why. And they're hoping to find some way to help them use it. But, you know, we never really signed a contract, so maybe they're using it, maybe they're not. People don't tell me.
Well, actually, speaking of Meta, I think as you probably know, today Meta just released its Llama 3 AI.
Yes, and they've announced they're going to release a 400 billion parameter model.
Right. Now, have you had an opportunity to look at that Llama 3 model? And if so, maybe it's too early to say, have you been able to test it for signatures of emergence of AGI? Have you had a chance
I
to look at
it? No. It just came out this morning, right. So I haven't had a chance to do it. It takes the Weight Watcher tool actually, I mean, it's on something that big, it would take a few hours to run, which is why there's a commercial version, because it can. So I'm working on getting that done. But, you know, we've looked at some of the similar models like Falcon, which were released by Falcon and Mistral. And we definitely see the same signatures in Falcon and Mistral. What we found in the Llama models, of all things, the earlier versions, is that even though they're trained very well, when you finish, they're much bigger than they need to be.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's something about training the models that you have to make them really, really big to somehow get them to work. But then when you're done, you should be able to shrink them. And that was something we predicted, you know, a year ago. And it's on the Weight Watcher AI site, the predictions. And it turns out now people have been able to remove 30, 40, 50%. So one of the things you can do with Weight Watcher, and this is a product we hope to roll out soon, is a type of carbon score for models. Because, you know, if you're going to run Llama in production, it's probably much larger than it needs to be. And you probably should find a way to shrink it because it's going to take a lot of energy to run the compute on it.
Let me just jump in there. I understood that these large language models thrived on masses and masses and masses of data. And what you're saying is that in some of these cases, they're bigger than they need to be. I thought that was the whole point, that you wanted them to be bigger, 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 and bigger.
Well, the point is that there's a bit of a trade-off, right? When you're training the model, you know, when Meta's doing, they're training the model themselves, there seems to be some property that nobody really understands yet, that the models have to be enormous in order for them to find good solutions.
Right.
So it's almost like, you know, you're trying to find, you know, you're in this mountaintop and you're trying to find the river, the valley, and somehow the more mountains there are, the more, you know, and the bigger the landscape is, the more chances you have to sort of roll downhill and go all the way to the bottom. And if you're sort of a small valley with just a few mountains, you know, you might try to go downhill, but you end up sort of halfway down and you never get down to sea level. Mm-hmm. So there's something about having these massive, massive landscapes,
right,
that allows the model training to get all the way down to the bottom of the valley so you can reach sea level. But once you're done, you don't need all that stuff. Like, you've got all this extra baggage hanging around. And one of the challenges right now is how to get rid of that extra baggage. Because, mm-hmm, you know, these things are expensive to run.
Right.
You're not going to be able to, if you're a company, you're trying to run inference on a 400 billion parameter model with a massive context window, that's going to cost you. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So there is a huge interest in trying to get these models smaller without degrading their performance.
Now, a couple of things. Mistral, you mentioned Mistral. They've been in the news recently. They've just, again, raised another $5 billion a couple of months.
Yeah, incredible.
A couple of months ago, it was $2 billion. Now it's up to $5 billion. And Mistral is French, right? It's a French,
yes,
LLM. And then again, I just saw that Microsoft has made a $1.5 billion investment in GP42, which is in the Persian Gulf. I'm not sure which of the states there. So Mistral is French. GP42 that Microsoft is investing in is in the Persian Gulf. In fact, GP42, in order to get that investment from Microsoft, had to cut its links with its Chinese investors for American security purposes. Not only talking about an American phenomenon here, we're talking about a global phenomenon. French, the Gulf, referenced China. What are...
Yes, yes.
So, again, coming back to Weight Watchers, I'm fascinated that you created this. You've created weightwatchers.ai to be able...
Weightwatcher.ai.
Yeah, we don't want to offend the weight reduction folks.
No, if you need data, I think that's a great service, but we're doing AI. We're not trying to lose weight here.
But it seems to me that now, so is Weight Watcher, again, you don't get feedback as regards the user, but any sense that beyond the United States that Weight Watcher is gaining traction, whether it would be with Mistral in France or in the Persian Gulf?
I mean, I have a blog post where we talk about why I think Mistral works so well. And I talk about this idea that there's this very special property called a Dragon King that we observe in the model. But are they using it or not? We just don't get a lot of feedback. In fact, for a while, I had a technology in the tool that was a sort of phone home system. So if you were to download the tool, it would send me a message showing, you know, okay, where's your IP address? What country are you in, et cetera? In fact, a lot of people don't realize that when you use open source tools like Hugging Face, they phone home and they track you. And you may not realize that. But when we did that, people like at Meta complained, oh, we don't want to use it if there's a tracking system. So we took it out. Because, you know, I want people to use the thing and I don't want them to feel that they can't use it because they're being tracked,
right,
or that the license is restrictive. So, you know, look, there is a group at Amazon who's been using some of the theory that had come through the Amazon Scholar program. So they're using it. Are the Mistral guys using it? I did talk to one of the groups in the UAE, which is associated with the Falcon team. And I didn't talk to the Falcon team directly, but I did talk to the group there. They're working cybersecurity. We talked about sort of how we might be able to use the tool with them. So it's one of these things. What we find, though, is that what I found is that people, you know, these teams are keeping a lot of things close to the vest.
Of course.
Right. So to what extent big guys using it, are the big guns using it? Well, I couldn't tell you. You know, we occasionally get clients who are more open about it, even the ones who are our power users. don't like to tell us what they're doing. Mm-hmm. there's just a lot of, I think there's so much money going into the space.
Yes.
That there's a lot of concern about IP, IP issues. So that's why that's one of the reasons I started working on a commercial version, just so I can sign an NDA with you so you'll talk to me.
Is there a competitor to WeightWatcher.ai at this point?
There's no direct competitor. What I would say is that there are evaluation frameworks. So if you train your own model, there are a number of open source evaluation frameworks where you can run the model through it. You test, how good is it at math? How good is it at coding? How good is it at human understanding? How good, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
The problem is that there are dozens and dozens of evaluation frameworks. So which one should you use? Should use them all? And, it gets expensive, right? Because you have to run these evaluation frameworks through the GPU. So you're not going to be able to evaluate, 20 or 30 of them. It's going to get expensive. So Weight Watcher actually doesn't even need a GPU. It can run on a CPU system. Mm-hmm. But the idea is that, the thing is that Weight Watcher is based on a broad theory called the HDSR theory, heavy-tailed self-regularization. So it's a theoretical, it's a theory being applied to the models. There aren't a lot of good theories as to why these methods work. Mm-hmm. They're just not there. Mm-hmm. And the stuff that is there, either is it gives, like, there are predictions, like if you use something called statistical learning theory, you actually get predictions that are opposite of what you see in production. So there's something wrong there. There are other people who have developed academic theories, but you can't apply them, right? They're just paper, they're very nice, they're very formal, there are a lot of ideas, but you can't take the theory and apply it. And for me, a theory has to be something that you can run experiments on, you can make predictions, and the predictions are either correct or not correct.
Mm-hmm. Well,
that's what science is.
Okay. You've answered my first question, which was the sum of the parts can't be more than the whole. I think you're seeing that the sum of the parts are, in fact, more than the whole.
Absolutely.
That with these emerging signs of artificial general intelligence. For the benefit of our audience, just define the difference between AGI and AI.
Okay, so I think when most people think about AGI, it's a little vacuous, a little vague, but what they're thinking is that there's some system that can somehow reproduce in a very broad context all of the things that a human can do. And I would not claim that, ChatGPT is AGI. It can't do everything we can do. In fact, obviously it makes a lot of mistakes. It doesn't even know yet how to be confident about the truthfulness of its results. So it'll give you something, it generates something that sounds good, but is it real? Mm-hmm. It's almost like a politician, right? It tells you things that sound good. So right. Maybe it'll end up running things. It might do a better job. But, the ability of it to do, mathematical calculations, or to give you accurate, if you ask, I need an accurate representation of something, it's really pushing the limit of what this theory can say. And this goes back all the way to the 80s that we knew that these systems could not do this. So AGI, I think it really will be a confluence of technologies.
I see.
And what we have now with AI, this modern AI, is really more of it has some sparks of AGI. There seems to be something about language that if you have enough data in the system that it can sort of track backwards and extract out some basic understanding of things from language itself. If it knows everything that everyone's ever written on the internet, every book that's ever been written, every video that's ever been produced, it can somehow backtrack from that and give you some primitive notion. My take on this, mine's a little different than I think some people have. There's a lot of talk about AGI being like a human, but I would say that I think of it more like flight. If you think about how man learned to fly,
right?
We used to strap wings to ourselves and jump off of mountains.
Icarus,
right?
And you'd fall to the ground.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, flight of Icarus. And of course, you could do that. And eventually, the Wright brothers figured out how to do this. But when they began to fly, we realized that there's a science of flying. There's lift and drag.
Yes.
And so now we have airplanes and we have, SpaceX. I don't think anyone would say that an airplane doesn't know how to fly simply because it doesn't fly like a bird.
Right.
Right. And so it's a different, once we understand the scientific principles of flight, we can do all sorts of things. And I think what we're seeing with these LLMs like ChatGPT is that we're beginning to understand something about intelligence we didn't know. Because we know not much about how the brain works. It's able to, it's more like a jet plane in that it has all the world's information in it. So it's very general purpose. But at the same time, it's not as intelligent as a cat. You know, it can't go catch a mouse. You know, it's a different kind of intelligence. It's very primitive, but it's also much, you know, it's not as deep as we are, but it's much broader.
On that score, let me pose a question to you. Have you come up with, say, the definitive signature test that when a large language model can do X, we then know that we've crossed that barrier. There's no question that this is, it's not just emerging, but it has emerged. Do you have a test in mind? And if so, when do you think that crossover point might take place?
Well, I'm going to answer that in two ways. First, I'll sort of explain what I'm doing, and then I'll explain what I think some other people in the community are trying. So with the Weight Watchers HGSR theory, and we've actually an extended version of this, I can determine when the model is properly sized and trained for the data.
Right.
So at each layer inside this model, so like each of these layers, it's like a stack. It was a stack of layers with weights in it. Kind of like going to the gym, you know, you stack up the weights and you lift the weight. So at each layer is extracting some small bit of information from the data, some correlations in the data. It's extracting it. And I can tell you with our theory when it extracts it ideally. So you have a theory. The theory suggests this is when the extraction is ideal, and you have a signature. You get a power law signature with alpha exponent 2. You get a volume preserving transformation. You get these technical things, and the tool will tell you, okay, you're there, right? The tool will just give you a thumb, right? Green light, red light, that kind of thing. Now, if every layer in the model is perfectly aligned with its data, I think we're going to see some very special things emerge, because it will just have extracted as much information as it can from, you know, as much learnings as it can on every layer of granularity. And what is it? Now, the thing is that I'm taking a look at the problem from sort of the bottom up. You know, what's going on inside the system, and when can you build a system that will perform ideally given the data that you have?
Right.
If you look at it from the top down, and I think a lot of people think of it from the top down, you're asking, if I give it a test, how will it perform? You know, for sort of example, there is a group trying to train, you know, trying to test these models to see if they can pass the bar exam. You know, I think lawyers are, lawyers are very expensive, and you know, we might want to pay a little, especially like me, you're running a company, you like to really simplify that process. So it turns out that you can, that these systems, like GPT-4, actually does pretty well at passing the bar exam. But the question is, did some of the data used to produce the test, is it inside the model somewhere? And so what's happening now is that the group doing, sort of one of the groups doing this sort of test are designing very, very, a new kind of bar exam. It's like a bar exam, but it's being designed from scratch. And they're trying to be very careful that the data that they're evaluating the model with did not somehow leak back into the model. So it sort of cheats, like, you know, it's kind of looking at the book to do the test.
Right.
And that's probably the hardest question right now in trying to evaluate these things from the top down, is that nobody knows what data's in it, right? We don't really know. And maybe they'll tell us with Llama 3, but you know, we don't know what's in it. And so you don't really know whether it actually memorized a bunch of information or whether it's actually able to make these broad inferences. So that's sort of the challenge. And there are some studies that show you can give these models a cognitive test, like the kind you might give my 10-year-old niece, and it will pass the model at the same level of the cognitive tests. And then there are more recent papers showing, oh, wait a minute, it appears that the performance on the test depends on when the test was made. So tests that were made later, you know, after the model was trained, it doesn't do as well on. So it seems, so maybe it's memorized part of the test. And we don't know. Like, that's probably one of the hardest things right now. But it's beginning to look, at least when you look at things like passing the bar exam, passing the MCAT, that there's enough information, there's enough broad information there that these things are able to do that. They're able to pass these basic tests.
So so that might be, so the ability of one of these LLMs to pass the bar exam, to pass the MCAT, to pass some of these standard exams to get into graduate school, you would regard that as a very strong signal of AGI?
I would say that it's a signal that the model's probably working in an ideal state. To say that it's AGI, I mean, people want, they expect things of these technologies that it probably can't do. So it might expect it to say, I want to have a confidence score that the answer you gave is correct. Can you tell me with, you know, even like low or high confidence, low, medium, high confidence, are you sure this answer is correct? Now, the problem here is that these systems, the way they're designed, they're designed going back to the early 80s when these systems first came out. They would make the same kind of mistakes they make now. You would train this model to try to recognize characters, like, you know, 1, 2, 3, you know, like writing on a check or something, or, you know, numbers. And it can recognize, you know, if you give it part of a number, it will reproduce it. So you give it part of a 2, it produces the 2. Give it part of a 6, it can produce the 6. So it can generate a number. But if you give it a 3, it might produce a 3 or it might produce an 8. Mm-hmm. Because 3 and 8 are too similar, and it gets right. confused. That fundamental property is still in these modern models 50 years later. Yeah, 40, 50 years later, they get confused, and they don't know that they're confused.
I see.
So it can't, the same model from 1982 that can't tell the difference between a 3 and an 8, the same thing is going on now when it tries to pass the bar exam. Are you sure? Are you confident of your answer? There's no one knows yet how to give confidence scores.
I see.
No one knows yet how to, and that's the problem.
I see.
Now, so it, I mean, even a normal, so I wouldn't say that, you know, nevertheless, the thing is still incredibly useful.
Sure.
Right. But I think that's one of the big challenges is people expect it to somehow know when it's right. And that's probably going to require more than an LLM. That's going to require some others. Just like I said when I started, you know, like the signature for me is signatures of a bunch of neurons sitting in a petri dish. Mm-hmm. That's not the same as a human brain, you know, which has you know, various parts and signaling systems and timing systems. You know, you have theta waves, all these things going on inside your brain. There are all these different subsystems that do things. Mm-hmm. And I think you're going to have to to get to AGI. We're going to have to construct something around these systems. The LLM will be part of it.
Uh-huh. Well, Chuck, at this point,
yes,
we could continue this conversation for days, but let me do this. What are your closing thoughts at this point as regards the emergence of signatures? And I would love to have you come back when, as and when these signatures begin to be more defined. But what are your closing thoughts at this point?
Look, I think there should be tremendous optimism. There's something going on here. There's a real, genuine scientific discovery, a real scientific surprise of the akin of the steam engine, of the akin to the discovery of electricity, and that we really don't understand everything that's going on. We're beginning to understand parts of it. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a tremendous opportunity both to learn far more about ourselves and how what intelligence really is in a much broader spectrum than just human intelligence, and a chance to build systems that will make our life a lot better. And sort of the sort of main challenge I've been working on now is how to help people build these systems so they can afford them. Mm-hmm. You know, so that they're small enough that you're not going to get killed on the inference costs, and that your carbon footprint isn't crazy, so you don't get dinged. Mm-hmm. But I think there's really a cause for, you know, and I know that a lot of people say there's a lot of hype, but, you know, if you just work with the system, you know, just work with ChatGPT, you realize this is not hype.
Right.
You know, if you use it for work and you're doing a job and you find, okay, I'm going to use this thing for my job, you may find out that you're 50, 60, you know, maybe you're 3 or 4 times more productive.
Well, Chuck, what new projects are you working on at this point?
So the main thing I'm working on is a new company called Calculated Content. And what that is doing is we're going to apply the technology. We want to go into industries and we can find people who are training or fine-tuning their own models and, you know, give them a carbon score, let them know whether the model is bigger than it needs to be, and try to help them find a way to get the to shrink the model to make it more cost effective, and to understand better how to evaluate these models to see whether you can get them to perform at the level you would like them to.
And Chuck, how can our listeners follow you?
Well, you can find me on Twitter. X right now is CalcCon, C-A-L-C-C-O-N, CalcCon, calculated content. I'm on LinkedIn, Charles Martin 14 on LinkedIn. And if you want to use the Weight Watcher tool, you can go to weightwatcher.ai. And there's a Discord channel. If you're doing AI research or you're just curious, you can go to the community and you can get me on the Discord channel. I'm usually there. I'm doing this 24/7. Okay. So I'm there all the time.
And on the Discord channel, what is your handle on the Discord channel?
Oh, that's a good question. I don't even know. I'm just on the Weight Watcher AI channel.
I see, the Weight Watcher AI channel.
And of course, if you're in San Francisco, I'm a local.
There you go. You're here in San Francisco. We're both in San Francisco. And as we know, there are dozens of AI companies and AI-related companies here in our midst. So again, Chuck Martin, I want to thank you for joining us today and talking to us about AGI and, most importantly, those emerging signatures. Thank you for being with us.
Hey, Jim, thanks a lot for having me.
My pleasure. And for our listeners, today's episode is number 514. Listen to us on Apple, Spotify, Pandora, 18 platforms, and wherever you listen to podcasts. Also, please join our audience in 60 different countries. FeedSpot has recognized us as a top 25 California news podcast, ranking us number 12. This has been the San Francisco Experience Podcast with Jim Herlihy, coming to you from San Francisco.